The Snake River Killer podcast is tracking multiple active and cold cases. This investigation is happening in real time. All individuals named and unnamed in this podcast are innocent until proven guilty by a court of law. This episode contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Where is Christina White?
Who is the suspect?
Detective Jackie Nichols believes there may be a connection between Christina White's disappearance, the murders of Christina Nelson and Brandy Miller, as well as the disappearance of Stephen Pearsall.
All suspected to have fallen victim at the hands of another. Law enforcement made a critical discovery shortly after the murders of Miller and Nelson.
The man that was working in the theater that night lived at the home where Christina White disappeared from.
He was very odd himself. He was more creepy, scary odd.
Opposed to the drawdown, so I agree with that, being suspicious.
She was on the porch and she waved goodbye, and that was the last time I saw her.
Hey everybody, Brandon Schrand here. Before we get started on this episode, I want to give a shout out to our new Patreon supporters. Jane, Corey, Maylee, Helen, Michelle, Cassandra, J-Mark, and Ray, R-A-E. I can't thank you enough for your support. It really means the world. Now, if you haven't joined our Patreon group, consider doing so. Anyway, I want to pick up where I left off in episode 16, and that is my interview with Lance's second wife, Debbie. While I was hoping for an on-the-record conversation, one that you could hear for yourselves, Debbie told me she didn't want the conversation recorded, so I'm going to do my best to convey the most salient parts of what Debbie had to say, which, if I'm being honest, wasn't much, although there were a few details that I think are worth looking into. When I asked her how she and Lance met, she said they were both involved in band at West Valley Community College, though she struggled to remember the name of the college itself. She confirmed that he had sustained an injury to his leg in a motorcycle accident. She also confirmed that he did in fact drive a white Alfa Romeo, saying, quote, "she pushed that piece of more than she rode in it," end quote. At one point, Debbie said that she knew Lance had been married before and that maybe he had had a child before their own, but wasn't sure. If he had or has another child out there, that's news to me. Also, apparently when he was with Debbie, he was employed, but she couldn't remember where or doing what. But it was in 1976 that they picked up from San Jose and moved to Melba, Idaho, and according to Debbie, their daughter was born in Idaho, not in California. As for their house on the Melba property, Debbie again balked, saying it wasn't much of a house. Then you can see pictures of the house and property on our website, snakeriverkiller.com. When I asked if she remembered anything unusual about her time with Lance in Melba, she cited two incidents. First, she said that she had gone to California for a visit and left her dog behind with Lance. She said that Lance, quote, hated her dog and that her dog wasn't fond of Lance either. But when she returned home from California, her dog was gone, and Lance couldn't explain its disappearance. She added, quote, "I couldn't prove it one way or the other, but there you have it," end quote. Meaning, she couldn't prove that he killed her dog, but that is what she believes is what happened. The second thing she recalled was that one day she found a badger, frozen solid, in her freezer. When I asked what that was all about, she said Lance told her the badger had been a pest on the property and that he had to put it down. Now, I guess I can understand all of that, but what I couldn't and can't understand is why in the hell you'd put it in the freezer. When I pressed her on this point, she said she didn't know, and that she just believed that he did it, quote, "to screw with my head," end quote. Something else that Debbie provided me about their time in Idaho, I find telling. The first was on the question of why he chose to move to Idaho in the first place. To this, she said he had followed some friends who had moved to Idaho earlier. These friends, it turns out, were members of the Bay Area Rally Force, Lance's gimmick rally crew. These friends, she said, owned a seed company and hired Lance. But he didn't last long at the job. They fired him, she said, because he wouldn't shut his mouth. He talked, 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 but never worked. After his failed seed job, he worked at Circle K, she told me, confirming what I'd already known previously. And it was during this period, 1977 to be exact, that Lance began attending Boise State University. From Orion, our confidential informant, I was able to get access to the classes Lance took at Boise State University. Like the classes he took in California, these courses could reveal his interests and preoccupations. Those classes include Preparatory College Chemistry, Essentials of Chemistry, Essential Chem Lab, Essentials of Chem and Lab, English Composition, Women in Society, English Composition, Nutrition, Child Psychology, Intro to Sociology, Human Anatomy and Physiology, Human Anatomy and Physiology Lab, Statistics, English Composition, Mixed Chorus, Weight Training and Conditioning, Nutrition, Current Social Problems, Human Anatomy and Physiology again, Human Anatomy and Physiology Lab, Microbiology, Microbiology Lab, Theater Practicum, Mixed Chorus, Psychology of the Human Personality, Sociology of Aging. Now, while in this case I have seen his grades, I won't share that information here, but suffice it to say that Lance was not a stellar student, which, when you look at his track record, isn't really surprising, right? Lance, by this point in his life, at 30 years old, is by all measures a total failure. A high school dropout who was booted from the Navy as unfit for duty, he can't seem to hold down a job for any significant amount of time. Nor does he seem to have any kind of career focus or goals. He's just floundering around, as rudderless as he is feckless. And now he has a daughter. According to Debbie, it was after his stint at Boise State University that Lance traveled up to the Lewiston-Clarkston Valley. It wasn't long after, she said, that she learned he had moved in with, quote, another girl up there, end quote. That girl, evidently, was his current wife, Patricia. Debbie and Lance divorced shortly after, and she and their daughter returned to the San Jose area. And why exactly he fled his 18 acres, ramshackle home, college studies, wife, and daughter to head 300 miles north is completely unknown, at least to me at the moment. But as you heard some of our team members speculate back in episode 14, the Q&A episode, a remote area with two rivers split between three states and with a small college might have been attractive. Once in the valley, however, Lance settled into an apartment at 309 6th Avenue, Apartment C, in Lewiston. And here, reports vary as to whether or not he attended Lewis Clark State College. He did, however, secure employment at the Omark Ammunition Company, as I've mentioned previously. He also got involved in the local orchestra, and this is when he began to get involved in the civic theater. Despite his short marriage to Debbie, they at least had two things in common: music and theater. In fact, Debbie was active in band while in school, and her parents owned and operated the Civic Theater in Saratoga, California, where Lance's mother lived at the time. But even though his mother, ex-wife, and daughter were all living in Saratoga, Lance was nearly 1,000 miles away in another world entirely. And that distance is something I want to press on for a moment. Lance hadn't been that far away from his mother since he was in Vietnam. Debbie told me that although she and her daughter lived, quote, 5 minutes away from Lance's mother, end quote, Lance's mother, Jane Nepudi, wanted nothing to do with her granddaughter. Not a single thing. Debbie would call Jane frequently in those early days back in Saratoga, but Jane refused to return her calls. One would think that a mother, who was by all accounts incredibly close to her son, would be all the more compelled to be present in her own granddaughter's life. I mean, Lance was 1,000 miles away, but her granddaughter was almost literally around the corner. And still, Jane Olive Nelson Voss Nepudi chose to ice out her flesh and blood granddaughter. I have intimated on this show before that the more we know about Lance's mother, the more we might learn about Lance himself. And I have to be honest, the more I learn about Jane, the stranger she becomes. This was something I spoke with Sam and Kathy about.
So, I interviewed Voss's ex-wife today. I didn't get much information that I didn't already know.
Which one?
This is Debbie.
Okay.
She had a daughter with him. She and her daughter lived for years, 5 minutes away from Lance's mom, her daughter's grandmother, and step-grandpa. And the grandmother wanted nothing to do with her granddaughter. Hmm. Like, Debbie would call Lance's mom and say, hey, you know, there's a birthday party or whatever. She said she would never return my calls. We lived 5 minutes away. She wanted nothing to do with her granddaughter, which I find that really fascinating. I think that says a lot about the mother, and it says a lot about it actually in a weird way, I think, sheds light, even more light on her relationship with Lance. Like, Lance is the thing. That's who matters. I mean, I don't know. I just find that really f***ed up. Like, your grandchild, you would not want anything to do. Like, so what, the marriage was broken up? I mean, who cares? You know, it's still your blood grandchild.
No, it's kind of like that thing Ryan Reynolds said, and I feel the same way, like, about my son and me and my father, you know? Like, up until the point my son was born, my dad probably would have done anything to protect me. He would use himself, you know, to protect me and put himself in harm's way if he had to. But the second my son was born, I didn't doubt for a second that if we were put in harm's way, my dad would use me as a human shield to protect my son. Like, you know, I don't matter anymore. It's pretty much, it's all about Thomas in it. Like, my mom's kind of the same way, you know, like, I was the apple of their eye, but now that Thomas is here, they're kind of like, goodbye, we don't care about you.
Yeah, that's always the joke, right? Like, you came to see the grandchild and not the child, right?
Yeah.
That's a trope for a reason, because that's how most of those sort of behaviors function in even dysfunctional families. That's how it functions. And so
it almost makes you wonder too, if her obsession with Lance or her following him maybe wasn't an act of like lovingness. It wasn't a caring act. Maybe she was super controlling and that was her way of micromanaging. And maybe he was trying to get away from her. She just kept following him.
There's a way in which you've heard this before, I've heard of this before, where the mother becomes so obsessed with her son, it's not really a love affair, but it's not far off. Anybody that threatens that relationship is cast out. And so the mother that's always saying that whatever girl he brings home is not good enough, right? And the only woman that's good enough for her son is the mother, is her, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not an uncommon, there's probably a clinical term for that. I just find it really telling that she wanted nothing to do with her granddaughter. And I asked Debbie, I said, so would your daughter be willing to talk? She's like, she doesn't give a shit about him. She doesn't have anything to say. She went to school one day and they asked about, oh, come to school and talk about your dad's. And she said, I don't know who my dad was and he doesn't love me. Debbie said that, quote, Lance graced us with his presence once when Rebecca was six and made all kinds of promises, but that was it.
Do we know about what time or what year that was?
She was born in 76, so like 82.
I had a couple thoughts about it. I mean, one is a grandchild obviously is physical proof that your son has had a physical relationship with a woman. And for a mother who wants her son to be a perpetual child, the actual proof that he's a sexual being is the grandchild. And in a weird kind of Freudian way, I think there's a possibility that that's there, right? And my other thought was, and this one is probably way off the mark, but because Jane would have known her son as well as anyone, and probably would have known that he had an ugly and horrible side, I mean, is there any chance that her avoidance of the grandchild was to protect the grandchild from the son that she knew was something of a monster?
I think the first scenario you posed was really interesting to me, that this grandchild is an unwelcome reminder that her son is a sexual being and could reproduce, makes him something that maybe she didn't want him to be. If it's a matter of controlling him, that act of producing a child is as out of control as the mother could be, right? Like, I mean, anyway, I found that to be probably the most interesting bit of information that she had.
So clearly, there's a lot to be said about the relationship between serial killers and their mothers. One of the clearest cases of this paraphiliac phenomenon is the case of Ed Gein. known as the real-life inspiration for both Norman Bates of Psycho and Leatherface in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Gane was a 51-year-old bachelor who lived on his family farm outside the quiet village of Plainfield, Wisconsin. Reared by an overbearing Christian fanatic of a mother, Gane was from an early age cut off from any kind of normal social world. Instead, he existed in a feverish maternal cocoon wherein his only social interaction and connection to the female form was his mother. After his mother's death, Gane began digging up graves and repurposing human remains into household wares, using flesh as lampshade covers and skulls as soup bowls. Most disturbing of all is that he kept heads, limbs, and genitals in boxes around his farmhouse of horrors. But on November 16, 1957, Ed Gane was arrested for the murder of Bernice Warden, an elderly store clerk. When police searched Gane's property, they reeled from the atrocities they uncovered. Warden's body was strung up by the feet in an outbuilding on the farm. She had been split down the middle, gutted, and decapitated. Police also found human faces Gane had skinned from skulls. Ultimately wanting to create an entire suit out of human skin, Gane would wear these faces around his farmhouse. Recently, forensic psychologists and other researchers who have studied the Gane case all point to Gane's fraught relationship with his mother as one of the central impetuses behind his horrific crimes. It is believed that Gane likely both loathed his mother and harbored sexual fantasies about her. Therefore, it is possible that when Gane was wearing the face of a dead woman, he was perhaps trying to get into the metaphorical skin of his mother, or to be his mother. So why, apart from the clearly twisted nature of his relationship with his mother, do I point your attention to the Gane case? Well, because as it happens, Lance Voss's grandmother, Cornelia Voss, lived in Lemonweir, Wisconsin, just 39 miles as the crow flies from the Ed Gane farm, almost the same distance from Moscow, Idaho to Lewiston, Idaho. Moreover, recall the date I mentioned a moment ago, the date on which Ed Gane was arrested, November 16, 1957. Yeah, that was only one day after Lance's 10th birthday. When I pinged the team on this info, Kathy wrote back, quote, "I checked Ed Gane, November 1957, in newspapers. 45 mentions in the Chicago Tribune following his arrest on November 16, 1957, the day after Voss's 10th birthday," end quote. Now, in the last episode, I mentioned the frequency illusion, and so I mentioned that because maybe this is one of those cases. But then Kathy wrote back, quote, "It's frequent, but it might not be illusory. Memories formed during late childhood through early adulthood, roughly 10 to 20, form what is called the reminiscence bump, a statistically recognized likelihood that we all have better memories for that period of our lives. Gane plus 10th birthday equals big bump," end quote. And to that reminiscence bump equation, I would add his grandmother's house, which provides an eerie proximal and geographical bump. Right after Kathy messaged me, Sam pinged me on a different topic. She included an attachment. It was a letter to the editor Lance had written, and it was one that I was well aware of, and I had planned on getting to in a later episode. But as a sidebar, I'll mention it here because it was bizarre and weirdly coincidental that she should bring this up right at that moment. The letter was titled, quote, "Shortage of Whales," end quote. In the letter to the editor, Lance wrote, quote, "On November 16th, the Tribune published a letter from Ann Heitzeman of Pomeroy, Washington, who wanted to know how we could justify spending millions of dollars to free whales trapped in the Alaskan ice when there were so many hungry and homeless people in this country who needed help. That's an easy one to answer. There are precious few whales left in this world, and altogether too many people. People are not an endangered species," end quote. That's it. That's the entire letter. And you can find a copy of it on our website, snakeriverkiller.com, under articles and links. So in Lance's worldview, not only are there altogether too many people in this world, but they are not endangered, and therefore what exactly? Let them die? It's clear once again from his own writing that he does not place any value on human life. And it's ironic, right? Lance Voss, the right-wing Republican conservative, is writing into the newspaper, essentially endorsing, of all things, a Save the Whales campaign. But the more I look at this letter, even that would-be endorsement rings false for two reasons. First, he really isn't advocating for the rescue of whales here. In fact, the whales, despite the title of the letter, seem beside the point. His subject is people. It's almost as if he seized upon not only the topic as an excuse to show his true thinking on the nature of human life, but it's also almost as if he seized upon the date November 16th, the day after his 41st birthday and the 31st anniversary of the Ed Gein arrest. As Paul said back in episode 13 regarding the Notes Plus article, Lance seemed and seems always to be looking for any opportunity to say out loud what everyone else already suspects. And second, this letter detracts radically from another letter he wrote that we mentioned way back in episode 6, Drawdown. Recall that Lance was essentially pitching a fit because there had been a plan to draw down Lower Granite Dam Reservoir by 28 feet, something Voss called, quote, drastic, end quote. And recall his hyperbolic rationale for why the reservoir should not be lowered. The reservoir shouldn't be lowered to save the supposedly endangered salmon because salmon were, to his incorrect thinking, abundantly plentiful. Then, in an interview on the same topic, he said, quote, "We see our lives floating away for a species you can buy in a can at the supermarket," end quote. In other words, in the first instance, it's okay to save the whales and allow people's lives to float away because people aren't endangered. But in the second instance, people's lives were unfairly being threatened because certain agencies wanted to conduct studies about saving salmon. In other words, Voss's pontificating and bloviating have nothing whatever to do with whales or salmon, neither of which I would guess he really cares about. And we know from his own writing that human life has no value unless his own life or livelihood is threatened. Then he makes the exception by invoking the collective plural we, as in we see our lives floating away. And by our lives, he meant his, or so I suspect. But again, I call your attention to that most conspicuous date, November 16th. Why? Because I'm beginning to see dates as playing a more central role to these cases, and that, as Kathy said, is frequent, but maybe not illusory. You only have to look at the Lost Husky ad to see that observation play out in fact. When it comes to the November 16th arrest of Ed Gein, though, we don't know definitively, of course, if Lance Voss knew about it or the ensuing news coverage about the bizarre relationship Ed had with his mother. Nor can we definitively know if any such news story had any impact on an impressionable 10-year-old in the form of inspiration or anything else. Still, though, even if I were to play devil's advocate and say that maybe Lance didn't read the newspaper throughout 1957, wherein the story of Ed Gein appeared 45 times in the Chicago papers, or close to once weekly, it's good to remind ourselves that 1957 was the heyday of television reporting, and that there were multiple network stations that not only assigned reporters to cover the case, but that ran newsreels of Ed Gein's arrest and haunting images of his farmhouse.
Filth and squalor of the suspect's house, lawmen have found a grisly collection of preserved body parts and human skulls and skeletons. Crime lab investigators are now trying to determine how long this man may have been killing and how many unsolved murders in the area he may have committed.
Certainly one could argue that Lance and his mother may not have had a television. Of course, the news would have been broadcast across all major and minor radio stations, and if by some weird fluke Lance had somehow not watched the footage on television, or heard about it on the radio, or read about it in newspapers, he most certainly would have heard about it from his family. After all, Grandma Voss just lived down the road from Gein's House of Horrors. Given the mass coverage and the absolute gruesomeness of Gein's crimes, I think it's more than safe to say that Lance Voss had, in fact, heard about Ed Gein. Also this past summer when I was down in the valley with Jackie, Gloria, and Jason Blair from Silver Linings Handbook podcast, Jackie mentioned how people who had known Lance and who had been to his house told her that he had a lot of books on serial killers. And to that end, I have to wonder if they included books on Zodiac, Carl Panzram, Ed Gein, or someone more contemporary like the Green River Killer. Not that owning books on serial killers means you are yourself a serial killer. My own collection of such volumes is depressingly extensive. And to be fair, that is essentially third-hand hearsay, so I have no idea if that's true or not. Additionally, when considering Lance's motivations to buy 16 acres in a ramshackle farmhouse in rural Idaho, we might also want to consider the following. Lance purchased the property in 1974. That's the same year that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre debuted across the country. And in 1976 and early 77, Lance had fully settled on his own farm and in his own farmhouse, which would have been the 20th anniversary of Ed Gein's arrest. Feel free to file under coincidence, by the way. I'm just pointing to the proximity of dates, if for no other reason than I think it's important to not just provide a working timeline, but to think about the historical context of each period. No one operates in a historical vacuum. We are all products of the culture that surrounds us. Now, of course, today we are saturated in media, but in 1974, you had television, you had print media, radio, and the cinema. That was it. All of which is to say, a single movie like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 1974 didn't have to compete with the total noise that we have now. And finally, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre debuted in October of 1974 and was playing in the Bay Area theaters during Lance's 27th birthday. Again, if Lance's grandmother hadn't lived just 39 miles away from the Ed Gein farm, I wouldn't even mention this. I mention it though because for me, parallels like through lines matter, or can matter. What do I mean by that? Well, you can learn a lot about X by examining X, right? But what can we learn about X by examining Y? You can learn a lot about Elaine Davis's murder by studying Elaine Davis and doing a deep dive on her victimology, reaching out to family members, which I've done, by the way, with no success. But what can we learn about her murder by studying the culture at the time? What was going on? What parallel events were occurring that might lend insight into her case or any other case? It could be anything from the Zodiac killings to the Manson family murders, which occurred just 3 months earlier. Here's another one, and it's something that FBI profilers have examined since the days when they launched their behavioral analysis unit back in the 1970s. What can we learn about this serial killer by studying another one? Acknowledging, of course, what former FBI profiler Julia Cowley told me about serial killers, that
if you've seen one serial killer, you've seen one serial killer.
Others can and have provided valuable insights into behaviors and behavior patterns or parallels. In fact, Joel Norris, whom I mentioned previously, derived his seven phases of serial killing based on a broad pool of data collected from a range of serial killers. So I was wondering about any particular serial killers who might lend some insight into the cases we're looking at, and one name that has been floating to the top of the team conversation lately has been Gary Ridgway, or the Green River Killer. Why him? Well, recall when Lance's one-time real estate agent and auto insurance agent Dolores Brereton told police that when she asked Lance where he was from, he didn't say Chicago or Tulsa. Instead, he said he spent a lot of time on the Green River and in Seattle, not far from the same city his biological father died in, and where Bells and Danette found the clarinet case full of knives. More critically though, at least for me, is that Lance said this to Dolores at the height of the Green River murders. And here's the other bizarre point about Lance's Green River quip to Dolores. If we are to take him at his word that he did spend a lot of time on the Green River, then the question needs to be asked, doing what exactly? As we've noted multiple times on the show, Lance didn't own a boat, he wasn't a fisherman, and he didn't like to swim or anything. So what exactly would he have Dolores believe he was doing on the Green River? It makes no sense. So that, in a sense, is primarily why we've been discussing Gary Ridgway lately. First, to see if we can glean any similarities between what we know about Lance and what is known about Ridgway. Second is that it remains to be seen if all the victims found along the Green River or in that area were, in fact, Ridgway's victims. It was something I wanted to talk with Kathy and Sam about. Is there anything that we can learn about Lance Voss, a suspected serial killer, by examining someone like Gary Ridgway? Same age profile, same racial background, that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely see some similarities between the two. In terms of lifestyle, they both had the ability to blend in and go undetected and create the impression that they're regular guys, right? Gary Ridgway held his job at the Kenworth Paint Place in Kent for, I think, 33 years. Like Lance, he was married three times. The first two marriages did not last very long. And like Lance, the second marriage produced a child. And his third marriage lasted up until he was arrested in 2001. And so I think that's kind of interesting that there are those similarities. I think it speaks to some abilities to compartmentalize, to be one person in one realm and another person in another realm. Another thing I was just reading that Anne Rule noted in the book Green River Running Red is that Gary Ridgway's violence began fairly young. he was about 13 or 14 when he attacked a neighborhood boy because he wanted to know what it felt like to attack someone. A six-year-old boy that he stabbed just once, a quick jab that pierced the child's kidney. When he pulled the knife out, there were gushes of blood. He felt ashamed for just a moment, but he walked away as if everything was normal. And it was sort of that excitement about that first experience that I think is similar, because Voss also had, we think, a real early experience with harming someone.
Right. So he would have been, Lance was 15 when Diane Taylor was murdered. We don't know definitively if he was the perpetrator in that awful homicide, but he's linked, right? So more markers than I thought between these two. What do we know about Gary Ridgway's family background, parents, his upbringing? Sam, do you know much about that?
Yes and no. I do know that he was raised by his mother. She was pretty controlling, pretty domineering on his end. I believe there may have even been some sexual abuse on her part. And I believe, like Voss's mother, everywhere Gary went, his mom was sure to go.
Oh, really? Okay.
And just to tag on to what Sam said about his mom, Rule goes into some detail about his first marriage, where he married really young and mom forced them to live in the house. She controlled all the finances. Mom worked at JCPenney and purchased all of Gary's clothes, including his underwear, when he was an adult. And then there are some sections from early in his life that indicate that he wet the bed until he was near puberty, and that mom punished him by rubbing his genitals, and that excited him. Reports that he had a fairly low IQ and may have struggled to manage money, or, you know, that she kind of took care of him because he wasn't super intellectual and maybe took on those responsibilities for him. And so he just kind of let her because it was easier that way.
Just really not functional in the real world, like not able to take care of the basic daily duties, which really, when we look at somebody like Lance Voss, not exactly the same, right? Because if we look at Gary Ridgway, low IQ, really kind of non-functional. Lance, on the other hand, although he failed out of high school, he got kicked out of the Navy. He wasn't a great college student, grade-wise, but that's not the same thing as saying that he's not intelligent. I think he has an intelligence about him. You can see it in ways that are definitive, irrespective of his connection to these cases, his sort of predilection for writing letters into the editor and that kind of thing. And I just don't think Gary Ridgway ever did that sort of thing. I could be wrong, but I don't think that was the case.
So I just found this document. I'll forward you the link, but I'm just going to read these couple paragraphs here. Gary Leon Ridgway was born February 18th, 1949 in Utah. His mother, Mary Ridgway, dominated the household with her brazenness and odd forms of child rearing. Ridgway's father, Tom, was a meek man who never stood up to his wife. There are tales of Mary Ridgway breaking plates over her husband's head with no reaction from Tom Ridgway other than to get up and leave the room. In Ridgway's history, it seems that his father does not play a central role except in that he never stood up to women and that he introduced the idea of necrophilia to his son. He worked in a mortuary when Ridgway was a young boy. He would often come home and tell stories of a co-worker who enjoyed engaging in necrophilia at the mortuary. In time, the story would soon become the subject of Ridgway's teenage sexual fantasies. He loved the idea of having sex with someone who is dead because you wouldn't get caught. No feelings. She wouldn't feel it.
Wait, wow, what? That's sounding really close to the wheelhouse of what we know about Lance Voss, because he broke into a mortuary with a camera, a flashlight, and a knife. So there are some definite patterns and similarities between what we know about Lance Voss and what we know about Gary Ridgway. But I have to say, that bit about the mortuary and necrophilia not only caught me by surprise, but I find that to be a particularly chilling parallel. But for me, what I'm becoming more and more interested in is that mother-son dynamic at play. how we saw it in Ed Gein and now Gary Ridgway, and of course in Lance himself. And from Sam's source, we learned that Ridgway's father was dominated by his wife. And that weird detail about how she would break dishes over his head. And that made me think of Lance shooting the dishes instead of washing them when he was married to his first wife. Also, considering the fathers. Ed Gein's father died in 1940, and of course we know that Lance's father died in 1948 at the age of 31. And Gary Ridgway's father was not only strange, but an almost a non-presence. The final thing I'll mention here about Lance's daughter, whom I've reached out to but haven't heard back from, is that Lance paid his last visit to Debbie and their daughter in 1982 when their daughter was 6 years old. He dropped in, Debbie said, and promised his daughter all sorts of things. All of this coming the same year Christina Nelson, Brandy Miller were murdered and when Stephen Pearsall went missing. After that visit, Lance became a ghost. In 1984, after Christina and Brandy's bodies were found, local investigators showed up at Debbie's door asking questions about Lance. When I asked her what her reaction was, she just said, quote, "I asked them, what did he do, talk them to death?" End quote. Later in the call, Debbie seemed confused by the point of why I was contacting her and asked me, quote, "What is this all for anyway?" End quote. I reiterated that I was the host of the Snake River Killer podcast and that we were looking into several murders connected to Lance Voss. She suddenly seemed shocked and said in an almost horrified voice, quote, "A number of murders he's connected to?" End quote. And I said yes, and that he was a suspected serial killer. And that's when she went quiet. Serial killer or not, when Lance moved into the Lewis Clark Valley, way up in the Idaho Panhandle in 1977, a dark and murderous cloud moved in with him, and unbeknownst to the valley residents, a long season of killing was about to begin. The Snake River Killer is a production of Resuscitate Media, LLC. I'm the host, Brandon Schrand. Original music is written and performed by the Young Night Drifters. Special thanks to Blake Walker, our engineer, associate producers and investigators, Gloria Boberts and Paul Dale, graphic designer, web guru, and investigator, Sam Sawyer, researcher and forensic science consultant, Kathy Belbin, research consultant and criminologist, Dr. Marianne White, research assistant, Tina Landriotti, canine and field search consultant, Florence Dickens, and her dog, Caven. Special thanks to Jenny Anderson and Vernon Lott for letting us air portions of their documentary, Confluence. Be sure to join us online at snakeriverkiller.com, where you can find photos, articles, maps, timelines, links, and where you can order your own Snake River Killer merch. And don't forget to join us on Patreon, where you can get access to exclusive content such as video footage, extended interviews, behind-the-scenes content, and much more. Next time on the Snake River Killer.
You know, I kind of thought she was too young and she had so much going for her, and it's just so sad and tragic that she didn't see that, and how much Lance being a part of her life influenced it could have been the thing that just was the last straw for her.
And his name comes up and I'm like, why does that name sound so familiar? And then it hit me. I'm like, oh my gosh, I have a letter from this supposed killer. And I'm shaking. I start sweating. I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me.
The lack of pregnancy and the end of the luteal phase are indicated by corpus luteum regression. It has to do with a substance that forms around the egg at release, but it seems to indicate that she wasn't pregnant.
Right.
Doesn't mean she didn't think she was, or maybe tried to convince Voss that she was.